On the night of May 11, 2022, a promising professional cyclist named Anna Maria M.O. Wilson was found shot to death in a friend's home in Austin, Texas. She was 25, at the top of her sport, and visiting for a major race. Within days, detectives traced her final hours, a training ride, dinner with a fellow cyclist, and then the quiet return to a borrowed apartment, before the sound of gunfire broke the silence of the neighborhood. What began as a local homicide investigation turned into an international manhunt. The suspected killer, another woman with ties to the same man Wilson had seen that evening, vanished without a trace. Her trail led investigators from airports to bank records, across borders, and finally to Costa Rica, where she was captured after weeks on the run. Behind the headlines, the case exposed raw questions about jealousy, identity, and the fragile line between competition and obsession. Chapter 1: The Last Ride. At 9:42 p.m. on May 11, 2022, the Austin Police Department received a call from a quiet residential block near South Austin. A woman had been found unresponsive in a friend's apartment. Officers arrived within minutes. They moved past the open door, through the small living room, and into a guest bedroom where they saw the victim. She was motionless, lying beside a bicycle propped against the wall. Two shell casings were near her body. The scene looked controlled, no sign of forced entry, no ransacked drawers. Detectives began photographing, measuring, and logging items in sequence. The victim's phone, bike, and duffel bag sat in plain sight. A half-drunk bottle of water rested on a nightstand. Within an hour, the apartment was taped off and crime scene units worked under portable floodlights. By midnight, identification came in. The victim was Anna Maria M.O. Wilson, a visiting professional cyclist from Vermont. She was 25, staying with a friend while preparing for a major gravel race scheduled that weekend in Central Texas. Known for her endurance and discipline, Wilson had arrived in Austin 2 days earlier. Her sudden death shocked everyone who knew her. The athlete. Investigators began their timeline by retracing her day. Wilson had flown into Texas that week for the Gravel Locos event in Lockhart, one of the country's toughest endurance races. Earlier that afternoon, she had gone for a training ride around 3 p.m. with fellow cyclist Colin Strickland, a local professional she had trained with in the past. Security cameras later confirmed her return to the friend's apartment before nightfall. Wilson's friends described her as focused and grounded. Born and raised in East Burke, Vermont, she had been an all-around athlete, alpine skier, mountain biker, and rising star in competitive gravel cycling. Her family called her M.O. She balanced a demanding training schedule with a part-time job and an active travel routine. In early 2022, she had been ranked among the top female gravel riders in the United States. Austin detectives learned that Wilson had planned a quiet evening before her race weekend. She texted friends about her ride, her gear, and her excitement. She had arranged to meet Strickland for a swim after their training session, then returned to the apartment where she was staying with another cyclist who was out of town that night. When police checked entry points, nothing appeared forced. The front door had a keypad lock, common in the area. The friend who owned the apartment confirmed Wilson was the only one with the code during her stay. That detail made detectives think the shooter either knew the entry code or had followed Wilson inside. The scene. Crime scene photos showed a compact space. The guest bedroom contained the essentials: a twin bed, a nightstand, a fan, and a bicycle repair stand. The bedding was rumpled but intact. Officers found two spent shell casings from a 9mm handgun and one bullet lodged in a wall. Ballistics work began immediately. The casings were marked and bagged. Detectives noted there were no signs of robbery. Wilson's wallet, phone, and cycling equipment were undisturbed. The motive wasn't financial. Neighbors later told police they hadn't heard a car speed off or any shouting. One reported hearing what sounded like a popping noise around 9:15 p.m., a short burst, then silence. By morning, the medical examiner confirmed Wilson had died from multiple gunshot wounds. The estimated time of death matched the reported noise. The Austin Police Department classified the case as a homicide and began its standard dual-track approach: victimology and timeline reconstruction. The timeline. Detectives started by mapping Wilson's movements from sunrise to the moment of the call. Morning. Text messages showed routine communication with her coach and race contacts. Afternoon. She met Strickland for a ride around Austin. GPS data from her bike computer confirmed the route and time. Evening. She and Strickland stopped for dinner and a swim at a local pool before he dropped her back at the apartment around 8:36 p.m. Wilson's last outgoing message was a short thank you text to a friend at 8:48 p.m. 12 minutes later, her phone went dark. By 10 p.m., the friend who owned the apartment returned home and discovered the door unlocked. Inside, she found Wilson on the floor and called 911. Detectives interviewed the friend first. She confirmed there had been no signs of argument or disturbance earlier in the day. She also mentioned that Wilson had been casually seeing Strickland, who was known in Austin cycling circles. That connection was significant. Within 24 hours, investigators brought Strickland in for questioning. The interview. In a recorded interview, Strickland described his relationship with Wilson as friendly and professional, though he admitted they had briefly dated months earlier during a break in his relationship with another woman named Caitlin Armstrong. He said he and Armstrong were again living together. When asked whether Armstrong knew he had met Wilson that evening, Strickland hesitated, then said she probably did not. Detectives found his timeline consistent with phone and location data. He had dropped Wilson off around 8:36 p.m., returned home, and texted Armstrong minutes later that he was running errands. But his messages to Armstrong stopped abruptly around the same time Wilson's phone went silent. The detectives didn't yet have evidence linking Armstrong to the scene. Still, the overlap in timing raised their interest. Digital clues. Investigators retrieved surveillance footage from surrounding houses. At 8:37 p.m., one neighbor's camera captured a black Jeep Grand Cherokee driving slowly past the apartment's alleyway. The SUV paused for several seconds, headlights off, before turning around. When the footage was shown to Strickland during a follow-up interview, he identified the vehicle as similar to Armstrong's. Detectives located the Jeep at the residence shared by Armstrong and Strickland and executed a search warrant. They collected the vehicle, electronics, and several firearms registered to Armstrong. One of those guns, a 9mm pistol, matched the caliber used in Wilson's killing. A ballistic comparison later found that shell casings at the crime scene were probable matches to test rounds fired from Armstrong's weapon. That phrase, probable match, was enough to justify further action, but not yet a conclusive lab report. The suspect, Caitlin Armstrong, was 34, a yoga instructor and real estate agent who had lived in Austin for several years. Friends described her as calm and athletic, someone who spent time outdoors and appeared well-adjusted. Her social media profiles showed photos of travel and cycling events with Strickland. When detectives first contacted her on May 12th, they asked her to come in for a brief conversation. She agreed. The interview, recorded on body camera, showed Armstrong maintaining composure. She acknowledged knowing Wilson and said she was aware of her past connection with Strickland. When shown the surveillance image of the Jeep, she did not deny ownership, but stated she had been home all night. Midway through the questioning, detectives learned that the warrant they were relying on for an unrelated issue, a theft of services charge, might not hold her. The paperwork error meant she was free to leave. She walked out of the police station and did not return. By the next morning, she was gone. The vanish. Detectives returned to the house she shared with Strickland. Her Jeep was still parked outside, but her phone was off and her passport missing. Credit card records showed a sequence of quick transactions. Cash withdrawal at an Austin bank, purchase of an airline ticket from Austin to Houston, and then Houston to New York. On May 14th, surveillance at Austin Bergstrom International Airport confirmed Armstrong boarding a flight under her own name. After that, no further domestic records appeared. By May 17th, Austin police issued a homicide warrant for Caitlin Armstrong. The U.S. Marshals joined the case, opening a fugitive file. The media labeled it a love triangle killing. For investigators, it was a procedural nightmare. A high-profile homicide involving professional athletes, multiple states, and now an international search. Family and community. Meanwhile, Wilson's family arrived in Austin from Vermont. They met with detectives and released a public statement asking for privacy and justice. Her parents described her as disciplined, kind, and deeply committed to her sport. Friends organized rides in her memory and set up a scholarship fund for women cyclists. The cycling community across the country responded with shock. Many spoke about how Wilson had bridged gaps between elite racing and grassroots events. In the days following her death, social media timelines filled with race photos and tributes. Investigators were careful with public statements. They confirmed the victim's identity, acknowledged a person of interest, and urged the public not to interfere with the ongoing investigation. Behind the scenes, teams of analysts continued to trace Armstrong's movements through airline manifests, passport databases, and financial systems. Building the case. Ballistics tests came back in late May. The firearm from Armstrong's home was declared a forensic match to the casings recovered at the crime scene. The report solidified probable cause for arrest. Digital forensics also supported the timeline. Cell tower pings placed Armstrong's phone near the apartment at the time of the shooting, though it later powered off. The vehicle captured on camera matched her registration. Investigators compiled an extensive timeline showing coordination between jealousy, opportunity, and means. They believed Armstrong had tracked Wilson's location through digital apps, confronted her upon returning home, and fled immediately afterward. But belief was not proof. The real challenge was finding her. The search expands. The U.S. Marshals Service took primary responsibility for the fugitive aspect. Working with Austin detectives, they began contacting airports and international partners. They learned Armstrong's last confirmed movement was from Newark Liberty International Airport on May 18, where she boarded a flight to San Jose, Costa Rica, using a passport that belonged to someone else. The name was similar, but the date of birth and physical description didn't match. Immigration records showed her entry, but no departure. That detail narrowed the search. Agents in Costa Rica coordinated with local authorities, tracing possible sightings at yoga studios and hostels near the Pacific coast. Still, weeks passed without a verified lead. Back in Austin, prosecutors finalized charges for first-degree murder. They issued public appeals and coordinated with the State Department for extradition protocols once she was found. Chapter 2: The Trail of Suspicion. The day after the homicide, detectives at Austin Police Headquarters reviewed evidence under the harsh glow of fluorescent lights. The facts were starting to align. A promising athlete was dead. A firearm from a known associate's home matched the caliber. A suspect had walked free after a paperwork error, and now she had disappeared. Detective Richard Spittler, the case lead, began mapping every move made by Caitlin Armstrong after her police interview. Bank records, airport footage, text messages, and vehicle sightings were fed into a timeline spreadsheet. They needed to know how she had left the city, how she had paid for it, and whether anyone had helped her. By the second day, the evidence pointed toward premeditation. Armstrong's internet history included searches for airline schedules and procedures for obtaining travel documents. A check with the Department of State confirmed she held a valid U.S. passport, but that document was no longer being used. The victim's life. While the fugitive search began, another group of investigators focused on Anna Mariah M.O. Wilson's background. The goal was to create a complete victim profile. Wilson had been born in 1996 in Vermont, raised in a family that valued sports and education. Her parents were both ski instructors, and her brother was also an athlete. She attended Dartmouth College, where she studied engineering and joined cycling clubs that competed across New England. By her mid-20s, Wilson was dominating the U.S. gravel racing circuit, a grueling form of endurance cycling that combined dirt roads, long distances, and limited support. Her training regimen was meticulous. Her social media posts chronicled workouts, nutrition, and race experiences rather than personal drama. The week she arrived in Austin, she had been preparing for Gravel Locos, a race she had nearly won the year before. Her professional trajectory was clear. Sponsorships, travel, and the steady discipline of a young athlete whose life revolved around performance, not conflict. That contrast, a quiet, focused life ending in violence, added urgency to the case. The relationship web. Investigators reviewed communications between Wilson and Colin Strickland. They had met through the cycling circuit. Strickland was a well-known figure in gravel racing, sponsored by major outdoor brands. Their text messages showed a friendly tone, mostly centered on training, gear, and racing events. The content did not indicate hostility or confrontation. But Strickland's timeline revealed complications. He lived with Armstrong and had been in an on-and-off relationship with her for about 3 years. During one of their separations, he and Wilson had briefly dated. When Strickland reconciled with Armstrong, he told friends he had ended contact with Wilson. Yet digital records showed they had remained in touch. Police confirmed that Armstrong knew about Wilson's presence in Austin. One friend recalled Armstrong expressing frustration that Wilson had been texting Strickland again. Another said she had made offhand comments about wanting to fix things permanently. Such statements, while not conclusive, began to establish motive, jealousy compounded by perceived betrayal. Forensics in focus. By mid-May, the Texas Department of Public Safety Crime Lab completed its first round of forensic tests. The shell casings from the crime scene and test rounds fired from Armstrong's handgun showed matching striation marks under comparison microscope analysis. The report used the phrase, high degree of probability of same firearm origin. Combined with digital location evidence, it created a chain strong enough for prosecutors to pursue a murder charge. Phone records placed Armstrong's device near the victim's apartment at the estimated time of death. The signal pattern, active, then abruptly dark, mirrored the phone's movement away from the scene. Investigators also uncovered a deleted message on Armstrong's phone referencing a tracking app once connected to Strickland's activities. It suggested she may have known his whereabouts that evening, including the time he dropped Wilson off. Surveillance and the Jeep. The black Jeep Grand Cherokee became a central piece of physical evidence. Detectives reconstructed its movements using private home cameras along Maple Avenue and surrounding streets. The vehicle was first recorded near Strickland's residence around 8:20 p.m., then later near the victim's apartment just after 8:35 p.m. Footage showed the Jeep idling briefly before pulling away. It returned 20 minutes later, headlights dimmed. The driver's figure was not clear, but build and posture appeared consistent with Armstrong's. When the vehicle was examined under a warrant, technicians performed gunshot residue tests. The results were inconclusive, neither confirming nor ruling out discharge residue. Still, the cumulative weight of digital and ballistic evidence was heavy. Prosecutors began drafting probable cause documents to elevate Armstrong from person of interest to primary suspect. The interagency handoff. On May 18th, the Austin Police Department formally requested assistance from the U.S. Marshals' Lone Star Fugitive Task Force. The case met criteria for federal involvement, a homicide suspect who had crossed state or national boundaries. Marshals started with the basics, passport activity, financial traces, airline manifests. They discovered Armstrong's legitimate passport had not been scanned at any U.S. departure point. However, another passport with a similar name had been used for a flight from Newark to San Jose, Costa Rica that same day. The photo on the travel document did not exactly match the official record, but Costa Rican immigration confirmed it was the same person. That flight became the key link connecting the Texas murder to an international pursuit. In Austin, back home, Strickland faced intense scrutiny. He cooperated with investigators, but received public criticism as the case made national headlines. News outlets framed it as a love triangle gone violent. Police took care to clarify that Strickland was not a suspect. He was a cooperating witness. Yet the emotional pressure was significant. Sponsors distanced themselves from the scandal. The cycling community debated the impact of personal relationships on small professional circuits. For detectives, public opinion was secondary. Their focus remained on locating Armstrong, tracking the escape. Bank statements showed Armstrong had liquidated assets before fleeing. She had sold her Jeep for cash to a local car dealer on May 13th, for days before boarding the plane. She then used that cash to buy an airline ticket under another person's name. Investigators believed she had obtained that passport from an acquaintance and altered it with her photo, a violation of federal law. Once in Costa Rica, she appeared to have changed her appearance. Witnesses later described her hair as darker, and her nose appeared altered. Authorities speculated she had undergone cosmetic procedures to reduce recognizability. Costa Rican records placed her in the Santa Teresa region, a popular destination for yoga retreats and surf camps, an environment where a foreign yoga instructor could blend in easily. Family and media pressure. Wilson's death attracted international coverage. Major networks aired segments detailing her career, achievements, and the growing manhunt. Her family remained in Vermont, communicating through victim liaison officers. They wanted accountability, but avoided public comment about motive. The community organized vigils. At each event, fellow cyclists emphasized safety, equality, and the emotional toll of domestic violence. The term crime of passion was avoided. Advocates pushed for more precise language, intimate partner homicide. Behind closed doors, Austin detectives felt the strain. Dozens of tips poured in daily, most unverified. Some claimed sightings of Armstrong in Mexico, others as far as Europe. Investigators triaged them, focusing on leads with verifiable identifiers. The Costa Rica lead. The first credible sighting came from a surf hostel in Santa Teresa, Puntarenas province, in early June. A traveler contacted the U.S. Embassy after recognizing Armstrong from online reports. The tip included a photograph taken at a yoga class, a woman with the same build and distinctive eyes. The marshals confirmed the location matched patterns from her previous travel behavior. Within days, coordination began between U.S. law enforcement and Costa Rican officials. Agents tracked financial transactions for lodging and food purchased under a new alias. Armstrong had registered at the hostel as Ari. Her stay had been extended several times, and she was reportedly teaching informal yoga sessions to tourists. Operational buildup. Joint teams planned surveillance before moving in. They needed confirmation of identity before an arrest. Costa Rican police watched the area discreetly, noting routines and movements. On June 29th, they saw the woman ride a rented bike toward a local beach path. Agents approached, detained her, and took her into custody. At the local station, biometric comparison confirmed the match. She was Caitlin Armstrong, wanted in the United States for first-degree murder. The capture. The arrest was swift and uneventful. Armstrong reportedly cooperated, but declined to speak about the Austin homicide. She was held under Costa Rican Immigration Authority, pending extradition. News broke within hours. Photos of the capture circulated globally. A tanned woman in casual clothing, her appearance changed but unmistakable. Austin police held a press conference the next morning. Detective Spittler announced, "The suspect in the homicide of Anna Mariah Wilson is now in custody." Relief spread among investigators. Weeks of sleepless nights had ended in confirmation. Back in Texas, the extradition process took several weeks. By late July, Armstrong was returned to the United States under federal escort. She was booked into the Travis County Jail and arraigned on murder charges. Prosecutors outlined the evidence: ballistic matches, digital footprints, flight records, and financial transactions. Armstrong's defense team entered a plea of not guilty. For investigators, the immediate priority was securing evidence before trial: witness statements, lab certification, and preservation of digital records. Chapter 3: Flight and Capture. 2,000 words, true crime, nonfiction forensic mode. When Caitlin Armstrong stepped off the plane in Austin on July 2, 2022, flanked by two U.S. Marshals, the fugitive chapter of the case officially ended. 49 days had passed since Anna Mariah M.O. Wilson was found dead in a quiet Austin apartment. The weeks between had stretched across two countries, several jurisdictions, and hundreds of investigative hours. She was escorted through a side entrance at the Travis County Jail, avoiding the waiting cameras outside. Inside, she appeared calm but wary. Booking photos confirmed the transformation. Her hair was darker, her face leaner, her expression neutral. The charge read first-degree murder. Detectives from the Austin Police Department were notified within minutes. The team that had built the case, Spittler, Espinoza, and their analysts, gathered in the operations room, silent for a moment before returning to their paperwork. The manhunt was over. Now came the long process of prosecution. The interrogation. Within 24 hours of her return, investigators made a standard attempt to interview Armstrong. She declined. Her attorney advised against any discussion without legal representation. The detectives expected that. The purpose of the meeting was procedural: to confirm her identity and document her physical condition after extradition. Still, the formality of seeing her back on U.S. soil carried weight. For the marshals, she was another fugitive brought home. For the Austin detectives, she was the human endpoint of months of evidence, frustration, and waiting. Investigators noted her composure. She answered booking questions clearly: name, date of birth, address. When asked if she understood the charges, she said yes. No statement about guilt or motive followed. The evidence in court. As the case moved toward indictment, prosecutors organized the timeline for a grand jury. They laid out the sequence. May 11th, Wilson killed in Austin. May 12th, Armstrong questioned, then released due to administrative error. May 13th to 17th, Armstrong sells car, liquidates assets, buys ticket. May 18th, travels from Newark to Costa Rica using another person's passport. June 29th, captured in Santa Teresa, Costa Rica. July 2nd, extradited to the United States. The narrative was direct, supported by documentation and forensic reports. Ballistics tied her firearm to the shell casings. Phone data placed her near the scene. The vehicle and surveillance footage matched her registration. Defense counsel challenged the scope of the evidence, arguing that proximity did not equal guilt and that possession of a matching weapon did not prove she fired it. The prosecution countered with the ballistic match, motive, and flight as indicators of consciousness of guilt. The trial preparation. Public interest remained high. National networks aired updates whenever a new development surfaced. Every pretrial hearing drew reporters. The Wilson family rarely attended in person, choosing to stay in Vermont and receive updates through victim advocates. Behind the scenes, the Travis County District Attorney's Office prepared dozens of witnesses. Neighbors, forensic experts, detectives, and airline personnel. They reviewed every element of the case under the scrutiny of Texas law, ensuring that all evidence had been obtained properly. Among the most persuasive witnesses were the forensic specialists. They explained how microscopic striation patterns on shell casings could link them to a single firearm with near certainty. Another expert detailed how phone location data, when cross-referenced with tower triangulation, placed Armstrong's phone at precise points near Wilson's apartment at the critical time, the fugitive's time abroad. As the legal process advanced, the public learned more about Armstrong's time in Costa Rica. She had arrived in San Jose on May 18th and traveled to Santa Teresa, a beach community popular with tourists. She rented a room at a small hostel, using a false name and paying in cash. Local residents later said she kept to herself, teaching yoga and surfing. Some recalled her using different stories about where she was from, sometimes saying she was from New York, other times from Texas. When Costa Rican authorities moved in to arrest her, they found several items confirming her identity: a passport belonging to another woman, a new bank card, and receipts for cosmetic procedures done at a nearby clinic. The clinic's paperwork showed she had undergone minor surgery, consistent with changes to her appearance. She had lived quietly, reading news about herself online through a borrowed phone. In that small coastal town, she might have believed she could disappear entirely. The victim's legacy. While the legal system turned, Wilson's family focused on honoring her life. Her parents, Eric and Karen Wilson, established the Mariah Wilson Foundation, aimed at supporting young women in cycling and outdoor education. They spoke publicly for the first time in late 2022. In calm, deliberate words, they said they wanted their daughter remembered not for the way she died, but for the life she built, disciplined, joyful, generous. In interviews, friends described her as modest despite her talent. She spent as much time mentoring younger riders as she did competing. Her training logs were meticulous, handwritten notes on weather, nutrition, and mindset. Race organizers renamed one event segment in her honor, the MO Mile. Cyclists wore her initials on race numbers that season. The community found collective healing through ritual, small gestures that recentered her legacy away from the violence that ended it. The public reaction. When Armstrong appeared in court for the first time, she wore a standard jail uniform and remained silent through the reading of charges. Reporters filled the courtroom gallery. The prosecution outlined the evidence. The defense requested additional time to review forensic materials. Outside, the debate over media portrayal reignited. Commentators questioned how quickly narratives of jealousy had overshadowed the broader issue of intimate partner violence. Advocacy groups argued that labeling such crimes as love triangles reduced the seriousness of the behavior, control, possession, and rage that often underpinned them. The court imposed a gag order on attorneys to protect the integrity of proceedings. From then on, only filings and scheduled hearings entered the public record. The mechanics of extradition. The Costa Rican extradition had been efficient by international standards. After her capture, Armstrong was held under immigration authority for using false documents. The United States submitted an extradition request citing homicide charges and supporting evidence. Costa Rica approved the transfer within days, citing treaty obligations. Marshals transported her back via commercial flight, accompanied by federal security officers. Upon landing, she was transferred to Texas custody. The cooperation between agencies was later cited as a model for international fugitive recovery, fast, coordinated, and legally sound. For the Austin detectives, it was a reminder of modern reach. The combination of digital footprints and global cooperation had made flight nearly impossible for suspects with high visibility. The cost. Even with progress, those closest to the case carried weight. Detectives often spoke about the emotional toll. They had followed every lead, seen every image, and reconstructed every second of a promising life cut short. Forensic analysts who processed the scene said the precision of the crime, the absence of struggle, the controlled environment, haunted them. It showed deliberation, not chaos. The case also forced renewed attention to the risks women face in relationships where jealousy or control escalate unchecked. Domestic violence experts used Wilson's case to highlight patterns of obsession and entitlement that can lead to tragedy. The verdict. In November 2023, after more than a year of pretrial motions, testimony began. Jurors heard weeks of evidence, digital data, ballistic tests, eyewitness accounts, and expert reconstruction. The defense maintained that the state had built its case on circumstantial links. Prosecutors emphasized motive and flight. They argued that Armstrong had tracked Wilson, confronted her, and fled because she knew she was guilty. The ballistic match and her immediate disappearance formed the backbone of their argument. After deliberation, the jury returned a verdict, guilty of first-degree murder. The judge sentenced Armstrong to 90 years in prison. Armstrong showed little visible reaction as the verdict was read. She was led from the courtroom without comment. Aftermath. The conviction closed the central legal chapter, but questions lingered. Could anyone have foreseen the escalation? Was there a chance to intervene before jealousy turned lethal? Wilson's family expressed measured relief. In a statement read by their attorney, they said, "Justice cannot restore what was lost, but truth brings a kind of peace. We hope no other family experiences what ours has endured." Cycling events across the country observed a moment of silence that weekend. At the Gravel Locos race in Texas, organizers paused at the starting line as riders lifted their helmets in tribute. For law enforcement, the case became a textbook example of interagency collaboration, how local detectives, federal marshals, and foreign partners could close a fugitive investigation quickly when evidence was solid and communication constant.